children's Benadryl.
Coming back here is great to be. Good
morning, everybody. If you turn to channel 18 this morning looking for our program, it wasn't there. I have no idea what happened to it. On Friday they told me it was supposed to be 7:30 in the morning, and we're going to have that time slot for at least a year. 7:30 this morning it wasn't on. Akel saw a thing on the internet that said it was supposed to be on at 7 o'clock. Well, I had turned the TV on at 7:15, and it wasn't on. And it's a 29-minute program, so at 7:15 it should have been going on. You looked at it at 7 o'clock, didn't you?
Before
7. So, and I kept watching it until 8:30. After 8:30, it never showed up. So I do not know what the glitch is. But that's one reason why we're not doing any advertising yet until we get it settled, you know. And we know. Also, there's one other thing. Interesting enough, on the advertisement that's on the website for the city, it says Chelsea Church of Christ sponsors. Okay, click this map. Click this button to get a map on how to get to the church building. They take you down to Edmond, Oklahoma. I don't know why it's doing that either. We'll figure it all out. We'll get it all ready somehow, some way. But it was very frustrating this morning. You know, I was all primed for it, and it just didn't show. Yes?
Well, the reason it would do that is that's where the program comes.
Yeah, but...
Somewhere there has to be a change made.
Yeah. We'll. I'll work on that this week. Because we'll be getting a new episode tomorrow delivered by FedEx. And I'll be taking it in on Tuesday, so, you know, we'll get her settled some way, somehow. This is not the first glitch. First glitch was the fact that I went down there, had it all the stuff filed and formed and letters and everything, and then they called me back and said, you know, we need someone who lives in the city limits to sign off on this. Oh, you couldn't have told me this ahead of time? You know, I've been talking to you for a month. So, fortunately, Philip goes down, and they know who Philip was, so it was fine. We got it all taken care of. Yeah?
Are these
the DVDs? Yes. And we will be getting the DVDs returned to us, so we will eventually have a library of these DVD programs. And the program today that was supposed to air was You Can Trust Your Bible, which would have been a good program. By the way, if you do go to the internet, searchtv.org, they, on Monday, they'll put a study guide for the next coming program. They will stream online the program that aired today, and then 2 weeks from now, they'll have a transcript of it online. So you can get those as well. But we will have them, a single episode on DVD. We'll be getting every one of those back, and they're ours. And they have a trailer at the end that tells all about the church. And I was looking forward to seeing how it looked on TV, and it just didn't work. Oh, well. Well, it'll get there one way or the other. Revelation, turn to chapter 2. We're going to pick up with verse 8. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things says the first and the last who was dead and came to life. I know your works, tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. And you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. Now, we've spent a little bit of time, and so we're talking about these things. The four things that Jesus says he knows about. And we've gotten down to the last one, the blasphemy, and we're going to talk about that again, pick up what we've talked about this morning. So the blasphemy, you might remember, is a word which means slander, detraction, injurious speech, something to a speech injurious enough to another's good name, impious, reproachful speech injurious to divine majesty, speaking evil, reproachful, railing, abusive. The word blasphemy itself is a sound-alike word to the Greek word. Okay? The Greek word is blasphemy. Okay? It's a sound-alike word. But if you're going to translate it, you translate it with something like slander or abusive speech. Speech that's designed to injure someone. Especially speech that's designed to injure the reputation of God. It would appear that maybe the ringleaders in their persecution that's happening in Smyrna, those who were after them the most, so to speak, may very well have been local Jews, because it talks about the Jews, people who prided themselves on their blood and heritage and were not real Jews, according to Jesus here. Now, one thing we need to understand is why they're not real Jews. And in order to understand that, we've got to understand the mark of the covenant, circumcision. If you'll turn to Revelation, if you'll turn to Romans chapter 2, this is where we were looking at just kind of hurriedly last week as we were concluding class. But in Romans chapter 2, verses 28 and 29, Paul is giving basically a picture of how things are in the new covenant. Now, in Romans chapter 8, 28 and 29, Paul writes, "For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God." And so Paul's point of view from the new covenant standard is that a Jew is not one who is one outwardly, who has simply gone through the ritual of circumcision or has been born into the Jewish nation. He's not a Jew anymore, the way God is looking at a Jew. The fact is, and the issue that he's focusing on is circumcision. Now, circumcision is discussed 77 times in Scripture. So it's a pretty important big deal. It starts off in Genesis chapter 17, verses 10 through 14, is where the ritual of circumcision is given. And it's given to Abraham. And it's given to Abraham, and it's going to be a sign of the covenant that God made with Abraham. What was the promise of the covenant? Anybody remember? Yeah, I'm going to make of you a great nation, and through your lineage, all the people of the earth will be blessed. Okay? And Abraham was to be circumcised, and Abraham circumcised his son. And from that point on, all those of the family who were choosing to be a part of this covenant were to be circumcised. Now we get into Exodus chapter 12 and verse 48. And we have a repetition, but given through Moses, that circumcision is absolutely essential to be considered part of the covenant people. Fact is, you cannot partake of Passover if you are not what? If you're not circumcised. We saw that as we studied from Joshua on Wednesday night. But in Deuteronomy 10 and verse 16, Moses makes a statement as he's talking to the children of Israel, who now are about to go into the promised land under Joshua's leadership. And he makes a statement that is absolutely important. But before we turn there, remember what Paul had said in Romans chapter 2 and verse 29. He is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart. Now keep that in mind. Now turn to Deuteronomy 10 and verse 16, and notice what is said there in Deuteronomy. Genesis 6. Sometimes I have to repeat to myself where Deuteronomy is. Okay. Deuteronomy 10, verse 16. You don't ever do that? You don't go through your head real quick, you know? Deuteronomy 10, verse 16. Now, it's in a description of the essence of the relationship with God, okay? And God is telling, through Moses, he says, this is what you need to do to be right with me. Therefore, circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be stiff-necked no longer. Now, he's obviously not talking about a literal circumcision, is he? He's talking about a circumcision of the heart. And it's kind of explained a little bit further in the next line when it talks about, you know, don't be stiff-necked any longer, all right? But here is the first hint that this covenant mark is going to involve the heart more than anything else. By the time you get to the New Testament, guess what? It's talked about in terms of the heart. The heart has to be involved if you're going to be a part of the covenant. That means that it has to be something that you voluntarily do. Because the heart, the way the Jewish people understood the heart not only was the seat of emotions, but the heart was the seat of decision making. So if it's a, if you have to be circumcised of the heart and be stiff-necked no longer, that implies that you have to do what? You have to make a choice, right? You got to make a choice to be a part of this covenant. That's one of the major differences between the old covenant and the new. Go ahead.
Like Christians are not necessarily Christians just because they profess.
Exactly. And it's also the reason why an infant who has been baptized just got wet. He's never really been baptized because his heart was not involved. Okay? That is Deuteronomy 30 in verse 6. You have another statement that's kind of interesting. Deuteronomy 30 in verse 6. Here is another, this one's telling you who is going to circumcise your heart. And the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all your soul, that you may live. Now, in the context of Deuteronomy, one of the things that Deuteronomy is doing is it's part of what Moses is doing is telling the children of Israel the things they need to know as they go into the promised land. But he's also setting the stage for a prophet who will come, who they are to listen to like they listened to Moses. That prophet who will come, who they are to listen to like they listened to Moses, because Moses was the covenant bringer or the law bringer. Okay, who is that person that they are to listen to like Moses?
Jesus
is. Fact is, in Acts chapter 4, I think, is where Peter actually quotes from that section of Deuteronomy and says, this is Jesus that he's talking about. So here he is talking about the fact that in the new covenant, sometime in the future here, but we know from our looking backward now, in the new covenant, it is God who's going to circumcise the heart, and he's going to do it so that we may live, and our part of the covenant is to love God. How? Yeah, with all your heart and all your soul. Okay? Now, turn to Colossians 2, 11 and 12. When does this happen? When do we become circumcised of the heart? What is it that allows... Now, it's obviously a work of God, okay? But where does it... When does it take place? Can we know when it takes place? Sure, because God tells us when it takes place. Colossians chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. In Him, talking about Christ, Verse 9 and 10 tells us that in Him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily, and you are complete in Him who is the head of all principality and power, talking about Jesus Christ. In Him you were also circumcised with a circumcision made without hands. Now, that's the circumcision of the heart that he's talking about. By putting off the body of the sins of the flesh, by the circumcision of Christ, buried with Him in baptism, in which you also were raised with Him through faith in the working of God who raised Him from the dead. Now, so what is the mark? Circumcision is still the covenant mark. It was a covenant mark with Abraham. It was a covenant mark with Moses. It's still the covenant mark of the New Testament people. But the covenant mark of circumcision is the circumcision of the heart. When does it take place? Yes, when we're baptized into Christ. We submit ourselves to baptism. In baptism, God works to circumcise our heart. So, baptism is the mark of the new covenant. It's just like circumcision was a mark of the old covenant. This circumcision, baptism, is a mark of the new covenant. If you have not been circumcised, circumcision of the heart, Colossians 2, are you part of the covenant? No, you're not. And you're not a Jew. See? So who is the Jew in this context? Well, there are Jews by race and by religion. Okay? But we know from secular history that there was a large population of Jews here in the city of Smyrna at this time. But whoever they were not spiritual Jews, not in the sense that the New Testament defines a Jew, because the church saw itself as the Israel of God, the true circumcision who worshiped God in spirit and put its faith in Jesus Christ. Turn to Philippians chapter 3, verse 3. You should be in Colossians, so it should be just back one page. Philippians 3 and verse 3. For we are the circumcision who worship God in the spirit, rejoice in Christ Jesus and have no confidence in the flesh. Talking to Christians, writing to Christians, we are, can't believe I caught that, we are the circumcision. We are the circumcision. Now, going back to Revelation chapter 2, it says they are Jews, but they say they're Jews, but they're really not, because they're not Christians. Okay, they don't bear the mark of the new covenant. And he says they also are a synagogue of Satan. Well, the synagogue is the meeting place for study and worship. Okay, it derives from synago, which means to gather together, to draw together, collect together, to bring together, assemble. An assembly of Jews would formally gather to offer prayers and listen to the reading and exposition of the Scriptures. Assemblies of that sort were held every Sabbath day and every feast day, afterwards also on the second and fifth days of every week. In other words, they divided. We meet on Wednesday by tradition, but the synagogue met, Monday's the second day. Friday? No. What is the fifth day?
Thursday.
Monday, Thursday, and Saturday is when they met. So they met three times a week for study and worship. Interesting little history there. But it also referred, synagogue did, to the buildings where those Jewish assemblies were held. Synagogues seem to date their origin from the Babylonian exile. We talked a little bit about this before. It actually has its origin in the practices of Ezra and Nehemiah. And the fact that when the children of Israel came out of Babylonian captivity, what did they discover? Remember Nehemiah? how they begged Nehemiah to get Ezra and have him teach us and all of that, and then they found out that, man, we haven't been keeping what? Yeah, we haven't been keeping the law. We didn't know what to do. So that was the reason the synagogue came into existence, was to make sure that people would understand and have knowledge of the scriptures. In the times of Jesus and the apostles, every town, not only in Palestine, but also among the Gentiles, if it contained a considerable number of Jewish inhabitants, had at least one synagogue. The larger towns, several. The minimum size of a community was 10. You had to have 10 men in order to have a synagogue. Now, they derived the number 10 from Numbers chapter 14, verse 27, the 10 spies. And they just kind of thought that was that's tradition. There's absolutely nothing in the Bible anywhere that tells any rules about synagogues, okay? But that was the tradition of how you had to have a synagogue. But the name transferred to an assembly of Christians formally gathered together for religious purposes. For instance, turn to James chapter 2, verse 2. James chapter 2 and verse 2. Philip, you got it? Anybody? Rachel?
For if there should come into your assembly a man with gold rings and fine apparel, and there should also come in for a man with gold.
Okay. What translation are you reading out of?
The King James.
Okay. New King James says assembly. What is do you have it now in the King James, anybody? You have synagogue. Most every translation, modern translation, will have the word assembly. But it really is the word synagogue. Now, what's he talking about? He's talking about the meeting together of Christians for worship and study. It's a place where you meet. That was the way they referred to the early church. Now, Christians came to prefer the word church, which in time came to stand for the place of assembly also. But in the first century world, when they talked about the church, they were talking about the people. When they talked about the place that they met, they often used the word synagogue. Because synagogue is a word that means collected together. Go ahead.
I was going to say, if you want to know that where it talks about respect of persons,
mm-hmm.
you read James 2nd chapter.
That's right. Yeah, and that's what that whole thing is all about. You know, and everything. But I think it's interesting, because what this lets us to come up with is that, before I go on, is that these Jews, these people who claim to be Jews but who are not, who are a synagogue of Satan, without any more knowledge than we have from the Word of God, you can come up with two scenarios. These could be talking about people who claim to be Christians who aren't really Christians, or people who are Jewish by birth who aren't followers of Christ. Either one fits the scenario. And in fact, taking it down to our modern day and applying it as we're supposed to do, because these are parables for us to put ourselves next to and learn from, it's telling us that when, as we live for Christ today and looking around us, we're going to see people who claim to be what? Claim to be Christians, or claim to be Jews, or whatever, claim to be right in with God, in covenant with God, who really are not. And sometimes those people will attack God's people, as they were in the first century. That is, when we go on, he says, behind these Jews stands Satan. He is not Abraham. It is he, not Abraham, who is their spiritual father. Jesus talked about that in John chapter 8, verse 44. Slander, that is telling lies to blacken the character of people, is one of Satan's weapons against the church. Revelation 12, 15 talks about, we'll look at that more in detail later, but it's going to talk about a river that tries to overwhelm God's people. It's a river of lies. Okay? Have you ever had the experience of we live in a denominational world, all right? And most denominations pretty much ignore one another. Okay? Have you ever had the experience as a member of the Church of Christ where people have attacked you for being a member of the Church of Christ? Yeah. And the reason is because we make a claim of exclusiveness in our ideal and our pursuit. We pursue to be just Christians only, and a lot of people don't want that. So there's some slandering going on. That's just one of the things that we ought to realize is going to happen. Again, in the letter to Philadelphia, there is a reference to those who claim to be Jews but are liars. They are actually a synagogue of Satan. That's in Revelation 3 and verse 9. And we'll talk about that when we get there a little bit more. But Jesus says, I know the slander or blasphemy. He sees their situation. He's aware of it and of its injustice. It's a reminder that nothing happens without his what? Yeah, without his knowledge and without his oversight. Now, by oversight, I mean that he's not causing it, but what I'm talking about is Romans 8, 28, 29. Remember that promise there? Whatever happens, God says he's going to take it and make what come out of it? Anybody? He's going to make good come out of it, and he's going to use that to help us become more like Jesus. So his whole goal is to take whatever happens to us and make it good so that we become more like Jesus. And that's part of what's going on, what he's wanting us to know here. Now, going on, he says, don't fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life. Now, let's tear this apart, okay? There are several words that we need to understand what's talking about in order to really understand what the verse is saying. The first one is fear. Now here, the word fear is Fabio. Now I know there used to be this guy, Fabio, who was had big long hair or whatever, you know. But Fabio, it's a form of phobos, but it's a different kind of phobos is terror, all right? Or phobia. But Fabio is a word which means to put to flight by terrifying, to scare away. So here we get the picture right at the very beginning. What is the goal of the pressure that's being put on the church at Smyrna? What's the goal of Satan? Turn the people from God. Scare them away and make them run away. Run away from God. That's Satan's goal. Alright? Suffer is paschal, which means to be affected or have been affected, to feel, have a sensible experience, to undergo, to suffer sadly, to be in bad plight, particularly of a sick person. In other words, to suffer means what? Well, picture being in a sick bed. Alright? Being in a sick bed, what's happening?
I've got this sore throat, man.
All right. You men, we're all going to confess here. When we get sick, what do we want our wives to do? Baby me. Bring me everything. Now, when our wives get sick, what do the men want them to do? Leave me alone. Do it yourself. When the kids are sick and the wife is sick, the husband leaves. No, but that's So this is the kind of suffering, you know, it's talking about being sick. I think it's a picture here that, you know, when someone is terrified, picture stage fright, all right? You get scared. Your stomach starts churning. The acid starts going. You want to run away, and you feel what? You feel sick. It's all because of the fear. So this is what Satan wants to do to us. He wants to do that to us with regard to our Christian walk. He wants to make us so terrified that we'll run away, and the symptom of it is that we're just tied up in knots. Okay? Devil is diabolos, which means slanderer or accuser. That makes sense, because what were they doing? They were slandering or blaspheming. Okay? About is mellow, which means to be on the point of doing suffering, doing or suffering something, to intend, to have in mind, to think to. In other words, it's the plan. It's the plan of Satan to do this. Okay? He's wanting to do this. Cast is balo, which means to throw or let go of a thing without caring where it falls. It means, you know, you're holding a ball, and rather than throwing it at somebody so they can catch it, you just throw it away because you don't care. It's what happens when you're going down the road and the guy in front of you rolls his window down, throws out his McDonald's bag, you know, or something like that. He doesn't care. He doesn't care what happens to us. Satan does. He doesn't care. We're like trash to him. That's the picture, okay? Prison is phylake, which means guard, watch, persons keeping watch, or guard, sentinels of the place where captives are kept, or prison. So he's wanting to basically, you know, put us in jail. The jail probably is not literal, or it could be literal. Nothing to suggest that it isn't, but it can also be the jail of our minds. If we are so terrified, someone who is forced to take a class on speech, okay, and he has to give speeches, and he has to do it in order for the grade, you know, that's about the only time you're going to get that person to give a speech, if they're really terrified. Otherwise, you won't be able to get them to do anything, will you? Person who is terrified of doing something like this, we're just talking about, will be in the prison of their mind. They're in jail. Because what are they not doing? They're not willing to try. They're in a prison of their mind. Tested. This is kind of cool. This word here is parazo, which means to try, make trial of, test, for the purpose of ascertaining his quantity, or what he thinks, or how he will behave himself. You ever hear the phrase, you have been measured and found wanting? If you are a fan of the movie, Heath Ledger's in it. He's a knight. Anybody know what that movie is? It's not First Knight. That's Sean Connery. And, what is it?
First Knight.
First Knight? No, it's not. First Knight is Sean Connery and...
came out with...
Heath Ledger.
He's the jouster.
Yeah, he's the jouster. Yeah. Well, they use a phrase like that, but it comes from Daniel chapter 5. In Daniel chapter 5, there's a vision of a hand, a literal picture. It's a banquet table of the Babylonian emperor, king. And he's sitting there at the table, and all of a sudden this hand appears and starts writing on the wall. Now, Daniel comes in and explains what the writing is, and in verse 27, one of the things he says is that this writing means, you, king, have been measured and found wanting. It's the idea that we are all measured by the things that happen to us. And Satan's hope is that we will be measured and found wanting. Of course, when you're found wanting, what happened to that king in Babylonia is Babylon, is that he died and a new one came in. Satan is hoping we'll all give up. That's what he wants. He's hoping we'll all get up. So Jesus is saying that's what Satan wants to happen. That's his plan for all of us. And so he says, you will have tribulation. Now, tribulation, we've seen this word before. Remember, tribulation is thalipsis. Where you, remember the idea of something from the outside squeezing and crushing? You know, it comes from the outside. He says, you're going to have tribulation. That's one of the themes of Revelation. All right? But Christ, by telling us beforehand, is indicating that as the all-knowing God, it's part of his plan and it's under his control. In other words, Satan may have one goal, but we've got a God who overrules Satan, and whatever happens to us, God can do what? Romans chapter 8, verses 28 and 29, make it good. Make good come out of it. Alright? So in John 16, 33, Jesus tells his disciples that in the world they'll have tribulation, but take courage, he's overcome the world. And that's going to be mentioned in chapter 3 and in chapter 5 of Revelation. Jesus is the one who has overcome. All right? In Luke 12, verse 4, Jesus warns us not to fear man who can kill the body but do no more. We should fear God who, when the body is dead, can cast us into where? Into hell. So, one of the things we can use to overcome our fear is a greater fear. If you want to put it that way, you know? I mean, think about it. You're terrified of public speaking, but your boss says you've got to do it. The greater fear of losing your job is going to make you do what? I'm going to speak in public, you know? The greater fear of hell ought to help us overcome whatever fear the world has to give us, all right? But Jesus, and 1 Peter 3, 13 through 18 tells us that we should not be afraid to suffer for doing right. We've got the example of Jesus who died. Verse 10 reminded them, going back to Revelation, of whom the real source of their trouble is, who the real source of their persecution is. It's, of course, the devil. Got to keep that in mind. Because people are the tools, all right, of Satan. But they're not really the enemy. Who is the enemy? It's Satan. Satan is the enemy. He'll use people, but as he's using people, we've got a mandate to try to do what with those people? Try to save them, right?
Turn them around.
Turn them around. And that's important for us to keep that perspective. He says this is going to happen 10 days. Okay? We need to remember that numbers really carry little or no numerical value in Revelation. They are used to describe. Now, this is the first time we've really needed to understand that so far. We do something similar to number 13, which means unlucky. Most people today consider 7 as a lucky number. You know, I'm not sure why, but they do. Numbers in the Hebrew language were often used as words. In other words, they meant something when you saw them. Numbers in Revelation mean more than the obvious. 10, you might remember, meant fullness or completeness. If a person has all 10 fingers and all 10 toes, he is humanly what? Complete, right? Nobody has, you know, 6 fingers. Or whatever, okay? 1,000 is tied to 10, and 3 is ultimate completeness, and we'll see that appearing later on. But 10 days, it was expected that every Christian should suffer as a result of his faith. Indeed, it was a proverb or faithful saying, 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 11 through 13. Turn there. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 11 through 13. This is a faithful saying. For if we died with him, we shall also live with him. If we endure, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he also will deny us. If we are faithless, he remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. Now, being a faithful saying means that this is a saying that should govern our life. This is a saying that we should have so that we understand this is what the Christian life is going to be about. And it's a warning that we can become faithless, but God will always remain faithful. Meaning, from one perspective, you know, there's kind of a paradox that's in Scripture that talks about how nobody can snatch, you know, if you're in Jesus' hand, nobody can snatch you away. Talking about things from outside, you know, I can't make somebody lose their salvation. You can't make me lose my salvation. But I can do what? I can choose to walk away. I can choose to be faithless. All right? But Philippians chapter 3, verse 10 reminds us of this, that there is a sense in which we will continue to make up or to be part of the suffering that Jesus suffered. Philippians 3:10, Paul says, one of his goals was that he may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings. In 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, Peter writes, 1 Peter 4, 1 through 3, therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind. For he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. All right? I guess I should have stopped there. But notice what it says. We are to arm ourselves with a certain mind. In other words, sufferings are going to come, but we arm ourselves. What does that mean? We prepare, right? We prepare ourselves. We prepare ourselves. Romans 8, verse 17. Romans 8, verse 17. Paul is writing that if we are children of God, then heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, that we also may be glorified together. Colossians 1, verse 24. Getting the idea that suffering is meant to be part of the Christian life? And yet, this is not a message that is modern preaching talks about much. I now rejoice in my sufferings for you and fill up in my flesh what is lacking in the afflictions of Christ for the sake of his body, which is the church. You see, 1 Peter chapter 4 taught us that the sufferings should lead us to living a kind of life where we seek to help others. Paul in Colossians 1:24 says, his sufferings help make up what is lacking in Christ's sufferings. I ran a certain article in the bulletin today simply because it picks up that thought. It's the idea that we are the hands of Christ. So that's really what it's talking about. It's telling us that what Jesus did to save us was absolutely everything that needed to be done. But what needs to be done to help people make it to the end, in many ways, depends upon us. We are his representatives, his hands in this world, and we're to help one another. All right? Okay, we're going to stop right here, and we'll pick up this point next week. The period of suffering is minuscule compared to eternity. And so we've got a little bit more to talk about with this, and we'll go into the next section after this. Any final questions or comments? Okay, thanks for a good class. Appreciate it.